Everyone here at Earthling Studios are strong advocates and supporters of the Australian Earth Laws Alliance. We understand that if we are to create a future on our Earth, we will need to protect it. Protect it from total exploitation and ruination by global corporations and selfish individuals. Along with direct action, this protection will be supported through rights of nature legislation. Rights of nature legislation protects all life on Earth, human, other animals, and plants. And it also protects lifestyles and social cultures from being ruined by aggressive corporate expansionism. The convener of the Australian Earth Laws Alliance is Dr. Michelle Maloney. She has plenty to say about how we can protect our planet's life support systems and preserve flourishing human cultures into the future.
Dr. Michelle Maloney is an environmental lawyer and is co-founder and national convener of the Australian Earth Laws Alliance. Michelle holds a Bachelor of Arts and Law with honours from the Australian National University and a PhD in Law from Griffith University. She is co-founder and a steering group member for the New Economy Network Australia and is an adjunct senior fellow at the Law Futures Centre at Griffith University in Queensland.
So we often get asked, what's the difference between rights of nature laws or earth laws and current environmental laws? It's a really important question. So if we start from the beginning, one of the reasons that earth jurisprudence has even emerged, this emerging theory of earth-centered law and governance, is that our current Western industrial legal system basically treats the living world as if it's property. Now, let me give you an example. So when the British moved into Australia in 1788, they brought with it an entirely different legal system to that which had been here before and immediately declared that pretty much all of the land belonged to the Crown, so it belonged to the government. From that, the government owns the land and it either allows private citizens to buy and sell it or they lease it. For example, they'll lease it to a mining company or they'll lease it to Coal Seam Gas or a cattle station. Once people have that right, either through purchase or lease, the right over property, they can often do whatever they want. If there's no positive covenants or there's no legal requirements to do a good thing, they can do whatever they want. And for people who are questioning, well, is that true? Can they do whatever they want? Just have a look at the statistics on land clearing in this country or the complete destruction of most of our wildlife that had any commercial value, pelts, furs, even kangaroos today. We treat the living world as if it's property. We are allowed, indeed encouraged through our current legal system, to use it up. And there are very, very few actual limits or even an understanding on what looks healthy in the systems we use. So the contrast is that the rights of nature movement states that from any way you look at it, moral, ethical, scientific, human beings are nothing more on this earth than a bunch of molecules. And we have evolved over billions of years in partnership and an interconnected way with all of the other life on earth. We can't exist without air to breathe, water to drink, stuff to eat. We are singularly interconnected to the living world. Rights of nature and earth laws wants to shift the current dominant legal system so that it actually respects life. So that life is not just property that we can buy and sell and do whatever we want with and occasionally stick in a national park or patch up when it's damaged. It has to be primary. And the reason I love earth jurisprudence is the way that people like Thomas Berry has framed it and the way that First Nations people talk about their own earth-centered culture is that the living world is primary and everything we do needs to fit within the healthy functioning of the interconnected ecosystem. So rights of nature, to me personally, is an effective way to spearhead a really important conversation. If you say rights of nature, people instantly get that you're trying to protect the natural world in a different way. They kind of get that you're challenging the legal system's treatment of it. So it's about both systemic change and it's also about really helping people to have the conversation that comes after, well, how do you do rights of nature or what does that look like? Then people have to be really thinking about how we use the land and the earth now and how we should use it. It's a cultural change. In fact, one of the five core themes of Ayla's work is changing culture, because our legal system is just a social construct. Some people act as if it's a law of nature like gravity, but it's really not. And you've only got to look at different cultures to see it, very different systems they had to govern themselves. And if we don't push back at the culture, if we don't help people in a compassionate way to understand the forces that are destroying the earth and what we have to do to stop that destruction, then we're going to fail in our mission to try to shift the system.
What are the main barriers preventing earth laws from being legislated here in Australia and around the world?
Well, I think the same barriers apply as those that exist right now to trying to save the natural world. And in short, it's the barriers of money and wealth and power. I don't really want to say the word greed, but I think it does apply. Right now, if we were to enact all of our environmental protection laws in the truest sense of how they were constructed, we might have a better shape of things. But what we can see, particularly in Australia, is the phenomenal power that large industry groups have over government policy, and a mindset that, I will be honest, I don't really understand, but a mindset within some political figures, some political spaces, I mean, and corporations, whereby the short-term game is everything and the big picture doesn't matter. So I think the barriers in any system to stopping the destruction of the living world seem to be ignorance or blatant maliciousness on the part of those who are happy to destroy. The destroyers have a lot of money, and they often have, as I said before, it's the crown or the government that gives permission to these companies to use the land. So it's those kind of aspects that are the barriers.
Do we need to rejig our corporate laws?
We could. It would be quite a powerful act. A lot of people have argued to rearrange the Corporations Act in this country under ASIC to place greater responsibilities on directors. That would be terrific. But ultimately, if we have a system that continues to believe that we can grow endlessly on a finite planet, it doesn't matter what systems we put in place to tweak that. If you want the Michelle Maloney version of how we address this, we have to shift towards living within our ecological limits and encouraging human beings to understand the culture shift that comes with that, and understand that they can't just expect so much of a planet that is destroying it. The information available today shows us our impact of industrial society. How we tackle ideas of greed, corruption, the notion of, you know, huge profits for small numbers of people, that's often framed as the 1%. We're seeing the widening gap between the rich and the poor. All of these factors are connected to resource use. So changing it is a complex web, but there's a nice manifesto on how we do that in some of the aspects of the work that we do within Earth Laws.
I see selfishness as being under the radar and probably worse than greed, because individuals, as governments and powers that be, separate us all, divide and conquer us all, we all become quite selfish and enabled to actually partake in these changes, you know, out of our self-interests. Does the Australian Earth Law Alliance actually write legislature, acts or bills for the implementation of earth laws?
We've been around for about 6 years, and our predominant focus has been supporting communities to understand what they can do in a time when there's a significant lack of government leadership. To date, we hadn't focused on specific law reform because we don't believe tweaking most of the laws in place at the moment would make any difference to how we care for the earth. In the last 6 months, we've had a rise in the number of communities interested in rights of nature, and we have been helping them understand what a rights of nature law can look like. So we've drafted a few for them. But to date, we haven't actually spent a lot of time trying to lobby or advocate to government for the certain shifts that we want to see. And I'll tell you why. There are a huge number of really awesome environmental groups in Australia, and many of them have a strong relationship with how government works. And we figured that, given, as I say, the complete lack of leadership by most government agencies and politicians, it really wasn't a space we were interested in working in. We're working on a range of pilot projects directly with civil society so that we can show different models for earth-centered governance, and then we'll come back and show so-called governments and decision makers a different way forward. So the short answer is, at the moment, we are helping community groups see what draft laws look like in an Australian context that focus on rights of nature and they're modelled on the existing laws in the US and around the world.
Can local government and councils implement earth laws, principles and values?
Great question. So to answer that question, I'll take a brief step back. So right now we have a legal system that was sort of made up when the English came over. We have started with state governments because they were the colonies. So we started with colonies. They were created over time in the first, you know, many decades or 100 years. The federal government was created in 1901 when we federated as a nation. Each colony gave up a little bit of its power to the federal government but kept most of it as this new entity, a state. So from 1901, in the Australian Constitution, we have a federal government and we have lots of state governments. And it's only the state governments that pass a law to then create local councils. So local councils are, by definition, just a creation of a state government. And the different powers that these different spaces in Australia have been created by our historical, you know, legal developments. Today, at the moment, local councils don't have as much power as state governments to legislate for the environment. So that's how the law works right now. But what's really interesting about the Earth Laws movement or the Rights of Nature movement is how it's being used in other places can give us an idea of what's possible in Australia. The situation many people have heard about is in 2017 in New Zealand, a river was given its own legal rights, so was a forest, and at the end of that year, a mountain. Everyone's very excited about this development, and it is really exciting and very important. However, it has emerged from the local specific environment, legal environment in New Zealand, where the Maori people negotiated with the government under the Treaty of Waitangi to negotiate these compensation agreements, including removing these ecosystems from government ownership and into having them as their own legal entity. Another example, it's a long-winded way of answering a question, but in the USA, a group called CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, help local communities fend off unwanted developments by working together to get their local council equivalent to pass a law that declares the rights of nature, but also self-governance for the local community. What they're doing in the US is a really interesting model because it's pushing back at state and federal governments pushing on to communities stuff they don't want. And they're pushing back at the notion that corporations can do whatever they want. So the US model offers some very interesting examples of what could be possible in Australia. So, for example, if a local council in Australia, particularly a local community that is perhaps finding that its waterways or river systems are under threat, that its very livelihood is under threat by decisions made at the state or federal government level that benefits corporations but doesn't benefit the local community, then that is a prime time for local councils to get more radical. And as the state of our earth changes through climate change, I believe more communities are going to face difficult times and large-scale extractivism of whether that's water or gas or coal or anything else will push communities more and more to say, we live here. This is our place. This is our home. We should have the right to stop unwanted developments and to protect things. So, in the Australian context, I have a feeling that some of the local law ideas will bubble up from the grassroots and they may shift through into the local council frame. But at the same time, there's nothing stopping us from showing state and federal governments what rights of nature laws can look like.
Duty of care is a prominent value in and principle in law. Can the duty of care principle be applied to the state government of New South Wales in relation to a vast ecosystem like Western New South Wales? What duty of care would apply here?
given duties or rights, they've got something to throw their case up onto and go for it. If nothing is written in the books about an obligation, they kind of don't exist. Indigenous law was different because it was written in the land. Law came from the land and everybody knew their place in it and the responsibilities they had. Western law is largely made up by the parliamentarians and the folks who make the law. Duty of care exists in most of our predominant environmental laws in this country. In the Queensland Environmental Law, the main act, it actually imposes a duty on all people to care for the environment. I guess I put back to you, how do you think that's going? Duties are really important. Theoretically, you could impose them on anybody in particular legislation so long as it was worded in a way that could be defended. For example, there's a big argument that we should increase the duties on directors via the Corporations Act to ensure that directors do a whole bunch of things to care for the environment. If you made those duties very specific, it could be reporting, it could be certain sustainability measures, it could be, trying to avoid harm to certain things or ban them from doing stuff, you could use duties as a pretty powerful tool. Unfortunately, this is going back to the hooks on the wall, you might notice that most of our state and federal government laws don't impose too many duties on politicians or the government themselves. And this is where we have a lot of interesting discussions. In some countries, just recently, I think it was in Dutch law, they were able to enforce an obligation that the government should have to implement actions to save us from climate change. A lot of people were pointing to this case that came out of Holland because it basically had citizens suing the government for being negligent in fulfilling its obligation under climate change. People in Australia were all going, oh my God, this is great. We can do that. We can challenge our government to do the right thing. And many lawyers at the EDOs had to say, unfortunately, we don't have that hook. We don't have that hook on the wall as a law imposing a duty on the government to act on climate change. So unless the legal system itself creates and imposes and supports the kinds of structures we want, you can't use the legal system. And this is why we haven't been able to challenge the government on its climate change policies. It's why we can't challenge any government on allowing coal. Nothing in the legal system is stopping them from doing it. In fact, it's actually all geared to support those developments.
I keep saying, what's the point of screaming at a bulldozer? We've got to legislate to stop the bulldozer. Surely aquatic habitat would be a priority to earth laws advocates. Are there any significant successes around the planet regarding earth laws and our oceans?
Ah, great question. There's actually a group in California called the Earth Law Center, and they're working on, I think they're calling it the Universal Declaration for Marine Areas. There's no laws that have been passed yet across international waters. But when you think about Ecuador and Bolivia have their own rights of nature laws in place, Ecuador actually has a couple of cases that have been used where the rights of nature laws have been used to protect animals in the ocean. For example, sharks at Galapagos, there was a really successful, horrific case actually where people were taking sharks out of a protected area and they used the rights of nature provisions in the Ecuadorian constitution to protect the sharks. But other than that, and there may be one or two other cases in Ecuador or Bolivia, there's not currently a rights of oceans law passed at the international level, nor is there a really massive civil society statement on it as there is for the Universal Declaration for the Rights of Mother Earth. So I do think that oceans are captured by the UDRME. So this Universal Declaration for the Rights of Mother Earth is a civil society statement, kind of the same status as the Earth Charter. It's the document that 30,000 people worked together at this massive gathering in 2010 in Bolivia. And it actually sets out what the rights of Earth are, and it includes rights of oceans and waterways and rivers to be healthy and free from interruption by humans. So
it's a good theory so far.
Yes, it's a good theory so far. But again, even if we were to truly enforce some of the existing international laws over the sea and some of the biodiversity protection systems, we would be in a better place.
The legislation of earth laws may be relatively simple for localized or small subjects. Is that so?
To tell you the truth, I don't think in the current Australian legal system, legislating for small or large ecosystems will be any harder or easier. The bottom line is our legal system does not yet have any capacity to do it. It's entirely up to communities and interested folk to be pushing for the change in the law. So in a lot of ways, pushing for larger ecosystem law reform will be just as easy as trying to protect a tree.
What about the complexities of a larger subject like an entire river system, like the Darling River Basin? Would it be based on fundamental principles or need to be a complex thing to deal with the details of such a big thing?
Well, I can give you some examples from the existing rights of nature laws around the world.
It does come down to fundamentals, though, doesn't it?
It depends on how you ask. See, managing a space comes down to fundamentals. Passing a law that recognises the rights of nature isn't actually that complex. So what I was going to say is if you look at the laws from other places, the laws themselves are fairly easy to read and they're actually quite beautifully written. It says something like, this river is a sacred entity, it deserves the right to flow, to live, to support life, etc., etc. But the day-to-day management of that will change depending on the culture and the context. But let me just give you an example. If someone in Australia managed to pass a law for a jurisdiction, say an entire local council area had the rights of nature, then any time a new development was going to be created, people would have to look at the integrity of the health, the integrity and health of the ecosystem before such developments could happen. If they passed a rights of nature law for a river, while the act itself could be written in a relatively straightforward way, the day-to-day decisions about what could and couldn't happen to that river will still be intricate. However, what rights of nature laws are meant to do is guarantee the overall health of the ecosystem. So it would actually make it a lot easier to say no. No, we don't want this pipeline that's going to suck all the water out of the river. Because that would actually take away from the rights of the river to be a river, you know. Or no, we don't want a coal mine that's going to pollute everything and kill all the fish, because that takes away from the right of the river to be a river. So I hope I answered your question, but the laws themselves are relatively simple, but how they would be applied would be the usual kind of management questions of how we juggle different interests. But fundamentally, the thing that rights of nature laws should do is make it a lot easier to stop developments that are going to destroy the whole ecosystem or large parts of it. And right now, that's very hard to do.
But essential.
Oh, it's beyond essential. There's nothing else. It's primary. Caring for the earth that cares for us, it's primary.
Does earth laws or earth jurisprudence include aspects of welfare for people, like human rights, land rights, or sovereign rights?
It absolutely caters for human beings. Number one, because there are no humans on a dead planet. Number two, because the rights of nature are seen as the rights of local communities as well. And I say local communities not to be anti-globalization or such, but fundamentally what we see are the abuses of power in most jurisdictions on Earth. If you look at international networks like Yes to Life, No to Mining, or any of the big NGOs, you will see the same story over and over and over again. It's predominantly corporations supported by their own governments, wherever they come from, but coming from somewhere else, moving into a place and destroying the local ecosystem. And every time defenders are trying to look after country, they're either violently removed or stopped, and the development still goes ahead. Often earth laws are popping up in places that are trying to fend off unwanted corporations and other developments. It's because human beings are creating rights of nature laws to protect the rights of nature and the rights of their own selves. And particularly the CELDEF model in the USA, the entire point of rights of nature and rights of local communities is to defend human beings and their capacity to live in a place. So this certainly earth jurisprudence is not about taking humans out of the picture, but it's about bringing us back into the picture in a humble and respectful way, and getting what we always say is that we are just one of the many species on this earth, that we are interconnected, that we have a moral obligation that our evolutionary companions aren't wiped out, but we also have a practical obligation. If we kill everything around us, there's nothing left for us.
Can you see that basic human rights are being breached through the diversion of river flows to the Lower Darling River?
The answer is absolutely. If local communities are being deprived of access to their local environment, then it's a violation of their rights. Fundamental, simple. And this is one of the reasons rights of nature is often joined up with self-determination and local council-oriented work, particularly from the US, is more and more. All people can see is other people, other corporations coming in and taking their resources, so they have nothing left to live. Absolutely. If water is being diverted, cut off, or even polluted, affected, or minimized, it's a violation of the rights of the people and the other animals and plants in that local area.
Is there an international court or body that can respond to or make a call regarding large-scale environmental devastation like that on the Lower Darling?
Unfortunately, the short answer is no. The only international court of justice that we have looks at matters between nation states. And this is one of the flaws in current Western legal structures. The whole UN system was designed after the Second World War, and although I'm part of a culture that was the victors, the whole system was built by modern Western-style legal structures. So international law, by definition, public international law, is all about nation states and how they work together and how we get along. So an international treaty isn't signed by every individual in the world, it's by nation-state representatives. Bilateral treaties are where two different nations might come together to agree to something. At the moment, there is no international court supported by or created by governments that would ever hear anything to do with what's going on by citizens in their own country. The only alternative that's been popping up in the last few years are actually the international... There's two. For the last 40 years, there's been a really fantastic civil society, so non-government entity called the PPT, the Permanent People's Tribunal. And it basically, it's like a bit like a superhero. It comes when it's called. When people ask for judges and lawyers to come together to hear an issue, it's often by citizens against their own nation, violations of human rights, violations of all manner of things like labor laws or the treatment of people. So the PPT is one place where people try to come together to hear issues and make statements. And interestingly, this year, the PPT was on the violation of human rights by fracking, and the court was asked to decide on those issues. Another civil society space that has emerged because of this gap, because state governments won't ever take cases to court, you know, that are going on in their domestic space, there's now an international tribunal for the rights of nature, which looks at both the claims by individuals and groups about what's going on in their ecosystems, damage to the people, human rights, and damage to nature rights. So,
There's talk in Menindee, Broken Hill, and Wentworth of a massive class action over legalized water theft and duty of care principles. Is it possible or likely for such an action to succeed in Australia? What about an international court or the United Nations?
First of all, class actions are not my area of expertise, but I would say in a general way that if communities can find any way to hold the government to account, use it. If they've got good lawyers who are looking at how to craft a class action against the government or the leases and the permits to the corporations or the corporate behaviour itself, I say go for it. But I really can't comment on what the likelihood is or how that might work. I'd be very interested to find out who's working on it and to understand more. It's a very interesting argument.
Do you think there is a need for a federal royal commission into water trading and pumping allocations along the Darling River Basin?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you could see the reluctance with which the federal government didn't want to have an inquiry into banking. And look at the dirt that came out from that. I think if they were... If the government was in any way able to agree to host that kind of commission, it would be pretty devastating, but potentially very important.
I think it would be so important for our future.
Yeah.
So given that you see a need for federal royal commission into water trading and water licensing in New South Wales, how are we going to bring that about?
Well, Royal commissions are a pretty huge investment by the government, and in many ways, from what I can tell, the kinds of royal commissions that have emerged in the past have come from extreme widespread pressure on local and state parliamentarians and federal to actually make it happen, to push for that. Again, it's not an area of expertise. I've never worked on a royal commission of any kind, but I would imagine if enough people band together demanding it and band together and push local, state and federal politicians, I think that's a way that local people can be part of the push for that kind of inquiry.
Dr. Michelle Maloney is an environmental lawyer and is co-founder and national convener of the Australian Earth Laws Alliance. Michelle holds a Bachelor of Arts and Law with honours from the Australian National University and a PhD in Law from Griffith University. She is co-founder and a steering group member for the New Economy Network Australia and is an adjunct senior fellow at the Law Futures Centre at Griffith University in Queensland.
The Australian Earth Laws Alliance website can be found at www.earthlaws.org.au. That is www.earthlaws.org.au. In March 2019, Michelle Maloney will be part of the Australian People's Tribunal Citizens Inquiry into the health of the Darling River and Menindee Lakes. The inquiry will be receiving evidence and testimony from people living in far west New South Wales. Beginning on March 19th, 2019, hearings will be held in Mildura, Wentworth, Broken Hill, Menindee, Wilcannia, Burke, Brewarrina and Walgett. If you or anyone you know wishes to make a submission or give evidence to the inquiry, go online to www.tribunal.org.au and find out how to be involved. My name is Mark Merritt. Thank you for listening, and thank you for caring.
Earthlink Studios is an independent media production collective devoted to informing with facts and trends about those things that determine our collective futures. To find out more about issues and matters related to the Darling River, go to the Vanishing River website, www.thevanishingriver.com.au. thevanishingriver.com.au